Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host this week, Erin Hudson. In this edition,
the response was outrage. People are angry, people are sad, people feel attacked by the government of Canada. People feel like after coming to Canada for 13, 20 years, this is the way they're treated over and over.
You know, I'm just going to go through as it is and accept it. If this is my journey, if the Creator chose me to go this journey of life and death, then I'll go through with that. So I'm not afraid to die.
But first, here are the headlines. A national movement known under the slogan Idle No More is sweeping across Canada. The movement started in Saskatchewan with four First Nations women who organized a series of teach-ins across the province concerning the imminent passage of the Omnibus Bill C-45. C-45 lumps together several amendments to different federal legislation from the Indian Act to the Navigable Waters Act. The movement's manifesto contends that First Nations communities have experienced a history of colonialism, resulting in outstanding land claims, lack of resources, and unequal funding services. Actions have been occurring across the country identifying themselves as part of the Idle No More movement, one of which is a hunger strike by Chief Teresa Spence, which we'll hear about later in the show. Another aspect of Bill C-45 are the changes to the Navigable Waters Protection Act, some of Canada's oldest legislation dating back to 1882. The former legislation stated waterways could not be blocked, altered, or destroyed without federal approval if water was deep enough for a canoe to float. Previously, 40,000 lakes and 2.5 million rivers were protected. Now, 97 lakes and 62 rivers are protected. Potential implications for the waterways now outside of federal jurisdiction include the new development or expansion of projects such as pipelines or power lines where the companies responsible will no longer have to justify before a federal government audience how they will avoid damaging these waterways. These decisions will now fall predominantly to the National Energy Board. The Egyptian government has now cleared Mohamed Majoub of all charges in connection to allegations of his involvement in terrorism activities. Majoub was detained by the Canadian government for 12 years under a security certificate and is fighting an ongoing legal battle in Toronto courts with the Canadian government to investigate the circumstances of his security certificate and situations that occurred during his detainment. Majoub, his legal team, and supporters state that they hope the Egyptian government's decision will put the Canadian government's arguments against Majoub on their head. We go to an interview with Victoria Barnett, part of a solidarity network called Support Majoub. And now a labor headline. In Ontario, teachers got a directive from the Ontario Secondary Schools Teachers Federation to cancel all extracurricular activities. Rotating one-day walk-offs also began throughout the province in protest of Bill 115. The bill alters the way teachers' unions bargain, and controversy around the bill has been brewing for months. Some students joined their teachers protesting the bill and the stoppage to their extracurricular activities. Students at about 60 schools are reported to have participated in actions. Also in Ontario, a week of action was declared across the province in protest of the provincial government's decision to make cuts to the Community Startup and Maintenance Benefit Fund. And a change of legislation now means that immigrant couples in a relationship of 2 years or less with no children must now remain together for 2 years in order for the sponsored spouse to receive permanent residency. The new measure is aimed at preventing immigration fraud, but some immigration lawyers and outreach workers have voiced concern that the probationary period could make circumstances even more difficult for a sponsored spouse in an abusive relationship. Immigration Minister Jason Kenney addressed concerns, saying that any abuse must be reported to immigration authorities who will assess the situation. In Alberta, the Provincial Court of Appeal decided at the end of November to proceed directly to the decision whether or not to approve Shell Oil Canada's Jackpine Mine expansion project. The court dismissed the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations request to review the consultation processes within the community, a decision that the chief, among others, takes issue with. Chief Alan Adams said that, quote, "If there is a violation of our constitutionally protected treaty rights, it should be dealt with before this project is found to be in the public interest. A project of this magnitude couldn't possibly be in the public interest if our rights have not been upheld and we have not been adequately consulted," end quote. The Jackpine Mine expansion would increase the mine's output by 100,000 barrels of bitumen per day. The expansion would mean open pit mines on Athabasca Chipewyan traditional lands, according to the community, and the Pierre River. The Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations filed suit against Shell in November 2011 and plans on opposing all future tar sands projects by the company, citing past unmet agreements and a lack of consultation. Hearings into the Enbridge Northern Gateway project have been taking place across the province of British Columbia. However, when hearings take place in Victoria, BC, spectators will have to maintain a 3-kilometer distance, according to a decision made by the Joint Review Panel members who are conducting the hearing. A spokesperson for the panel said the decision was made based on a history of demonstrations in Victoria and Vancouver and the need to maintain a respectful atmosphere throughout the hearings. Environmental groups, interviewed by Victoria Times columnist, expressed surprise by the decision. And our final headline looks at a new smartphone app developed by two Canadian law students and inspired by recent acts of civil disobedience in Canada.
A few years ago, when I lived in Vancouver, we hosted the Olympics in 2010. And so that was a big time for the Civil Liberties Association to look at, you know, people are going to be protesting what are they going to do when they run into cops and what are the cops going to do? And there was a whole other thing called the Legal Observer Program they did at the time. But so I guess, generally speaking, yeah, these kinds of massive protests, when you look at the protests that happened during the Olympics, the protests at the G8 in Toronto, and then, of course, the protests about the tuition hike here last spring, kind of more generally factored in for me.
Paul Holden is the McGill Law student who developed the Android app called Your Rights in Canada.
How it came about was I thought the BC Civil Liberties Association publishes a whole bunch of handbooks, information about your rights, different kinds of things, and one of them is an arrest rights handbook. And then there's a corresponding arrest rights pocketbook. And the idea of the pocketbook is it's small format, fits in your pocket. You can carry it with you, and so you have, you know, something you can thumb through if you need it or if a friend needs it. So my thinking was, I doubt many people are actually carrying pocketbooks in their pocket, but a lot of people, an increasing number of people, a phenomenal number of people really, are carrying mobile phones in their pockets all the time. So if I make this into an app, then it really will be in everybody's pocket. I mean, anybody's pocket who wants it. It's specifically around your interaction with the police. So when you're being questioned by the police, whether you have to identify yourself to the police, in what situations you have to identify yourself, what authority the police have to search you, what it means, you know, what the distinction is between being detained and being under arrest, and what your rights are in these different scenarios. So it's covering, and I guess a lot of that is derived from the Charter. And it was written in the BC context by the BC Civil Liberties Association.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. That was Only Sleeping by Ott from their EP album, New Calm. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes out of Victoria Island in the Ottawa River. It's a location where First Nations Chief Teresa Spence is conducting a hunger strike, one of several actions taking place across Canada as part of the Idle No More movement. She's gone without eating since December 11th, and has said her strike will continue until she obtains a meeting with the Prime Minister. We go to a feature interview with Chief Spence, conducted by journalist Maddie Pedluska on the first day of Spence's hunger strike.
So I bought this to, and this is my mom's blanket.
This is now home to Chief Teresa Spence, a teepee on Victoria Island, as she starts her hunger strike.
And I know it's going to get tougher, and I know my mind's going to get weak, and my whole body's going to get weak, and I'm just going to go through as it is and accept it. If this is my journey, if the Creator chose me to go this journey of life and death, then I'll go through with that. So I'm not afraid to die.
She's willing to die for her people, she says. Canada's First Nations communities, disrespected and ignored, she says, by the country's federal government.
The government fails to recognize our ways. It's a thought that scares you as a First Nation. Like, when is this going to stop? Like, why is the government controlling our lives and our children's future?
At a sunrise ceremony, the community spoke about the need to regain control over education, housing, and environmental rights, and to be involved in the government's decision-making process. Something the chief says was lost with the implementation of the Indian Act.
That Indian Act was imposed to us. We never agreed to it. And when you're in that Indian Act, you're in the system. And that system controls everything. Everything what we want to do as our own governance. So this generation of our youth deserves better, not to live in that system. Because we've been through that system, and we know how it is. And it's not a good life. You feel like you're like a slave in a person. So we don't want our kids to go through that.
And she will now survive only on water as a symbol of protest, urging both the government and the Crown to sit with Canada's First Nations communities to address their troubled relationship.
There are three parties there. And right now, us First Nations, our voices are not heard.
Her efforts have received the blessing and support of First Nations elders. But some members in her community, like Thomas Luden, fear for her life.
We need those people to continue their work and speak for us and fight for us. Many of our elders don't have that experience of speaking to the government. I hope she will continue living.
But the chief says her hunger strike has now become her way of speaking for the well-being and the future of Canada's First Nations communities.
We have a treaty, and that treaty is about friendship, peace, and building the future together, not taking control of anybody's life. It hurts to see our people treated like this, like it's too much, and it's not, helping our youth. And all we're asking is to be part of our country.
To watch the video of this interview, go to the channel One Year, One World at Vimeo.com. The video is part of an ongoing project by independent journalist Maggie Pedluska. Our next feature examines the environmental principles at play in a recent Supreme Court case out of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Friends of the Earth looks for opportunities to intervene in cases that make it to the Supreme Court around certain important environmental principles like polluter pays, also intergenerational equity, and the precautionary principle. But in this case, the case arrived at the Supreme Court between Abitibi-Bowater and the province of Newfoundland. And the province of Newfoundland, in their arguments, dealt with the question of polluter pays. Friends of the Earth, which is represented by EcoJustice in this case, determined that this was a very unusual and perhaps first ever opportunity to see how polluter pays would work in the bankruptcy and insolvency process.
That was Beatrice Olivastri with the organization Friends of the Earth. Abitibi-Bowater was a pulp and paper company that went bankrupt. In the case between Abitibi Bowater and the province of Newfoundland and Labrador, the province took over the company's assets after Abitibi Bowater declared bankruptcy.
The decision itself was not whether or not polluter pays stands, because the court decision is clearly says polluter pays does stand. But the reason it looks like Abitibi won is that they said, while polluter pays stands, the province, because it's both the regulator and owner, had to line up with the other creditors for the money. So it's a case where it became about the actual money involved in the cleanup rather than whether or not they should do it. So it is a challenging decision from the courts in that we believe it does not dilute polluter pays. They're very clear to say this is not about a third party needing to pay, but because it's in the bankruptcy and insolvency process in Canada, they're saying that Newfoundland would have to seek the cost, which would be from their commitment to clean up and then get the money from the company. They would have to seek it along with the other creditors. And that process has already been finalized. So Newfoundland ends up holding the bag on this.
And so the taxpayers then in Newfoundland, some degree, end up...
They have the hit of the cost of cleanup on the assumption that Newfoundland does clean up. And we sincerely hope they will. But the cost of cleanup is in excess of the Department of Environment's annual budget. So $100 million-plus could be the cost. And there's some lessons from this case that we would like to put forward with the provinces across the country, which is that regulating in real time, enforcing regulations in real time, and requiring that cleanup as identified is really critical, so that we don't end up in this situation with companies that try to walk away, and that's what we think Abitibi's done. And the other thing is that we think when licenses and permits are being issued, that governments should be at that time assessing likely pollution. Many of these natural resource processes cause pollution by their nature. But by assessing that when the license and permit is issued, whether it's insurance or a bond or something else, one, we think taxpayers will be protected from the cost of cleanup, and two, we think it will influence the companies to use the most advanced pollution abatement technologies then. So maybe they'll cause less pollution if they know they actually have to pay for it.
In a hotel at the bar, wondering if I have taken it too far, if I was ever that young. While blacking out the squares in the crossword of a magazine, you say, you gotta go. Stare down at the blotched ink, tear it up and fold it up and put it in the pocket of your blouse. And forget I'm the only one who can remember.
As of early December, migrant workers were told they would no longer be able to access paternal, maternal, or compassionate benefits from the Employment Insurance, or EI, program. The migrant workers affected are employed under Canada's Temporary Foreign Worker Program. Zenza from the organization Justicia for Migrant Workers explains the impact of this cut in our next feature.
My name is Tasna Miranda, and I am an organizer for Justicia for Migrant Workers.
Justicia opposes the cut in special benefits for migrant workers.
This money has allowed families to provide necessary health care for the mother and or the baby. Sometimes in emergency situations, it's allowed them to feed their kids, to build a better, safer house for them, and often has allowed for workers to pay for their kids' education.
Okay, and so the parental benefits, that would only go to workers who have families in Canada or anywhere?
Anywhere. It's actually usually received when workers are back home and they're not working, when they've had a child in a year that they were working in Canada.
What has been the response on the ground?
So last Sunday, December 9th, Justicia for Migrant Workers organized our annual holiday dinner in Leamington, Ontario, a place that sees more than 8,000 migrant workers come to work in its farms and factories. And at this dinner, we had almost 100 workers from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Jamaica, Trinidad, Peru, the Philippines, and Thailand. And the announcement from HRSDC Canada had just come out, so we spoke about this at this community meeting, and the response was outrage. People are angry, people are sad, people feel attacked by the government of Canada, people feel like after coming to Canada for 13, 20 years, this is the way they're treated over and over. They feel like more and more the government of Canada is taking away their very, very few rights that they do have. And many of the workers that were in those meetings have received parental benefits and have been able to use that money to provide their families with dignified, safe lives back home.
And I guess moving forward, is there any plan for how to address these cuts now?
Yes. So we plan to fight back as hard as we can. We're going to continue to organize with workers across borders. So we're going to be working transnationally, and of course in Canada. We're going to have a few actions. We want to let Diane Finley, the Minister of HRSDC, know that these policies will not be taken lightly, and even though she will try to pass them quietly on a Thursday, that's not what's going to happen. So do keep an eye out for our actions. We're planning some in December and some in January, and the details will come out soon. You can read all about them in justiciaformigrantworkers.org, and we also have a Justicia for Migrant Workers Facebook group that we often update with all of our events. And we're asking everyone to write letters to HRSDC, to Diane Finley, to their MPs, and write about the fact that we in Canada do not support these cuts, and we do not support the way migrant workers are being treated. We are not going to take this sitting down, and workers won't take this sitting down. We're going to fight back, and we're not going to take these cuts.
And our final feature comes from CFRU in Guelph, Ontario. Mandy Hiscox joined Guelph Prison Radio to discuss a human rights application she filed with the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal just before her release from prison.
My name's Mandy, and I'm just back in Guelph. I've been away for a while because I received a jail sentence for some organizing against the G20 back in 2010. So I just finished about, I think it was like 10 and two-thirds months at Vanier Center for Women, and I got out on December 3rd. Just before I got out, so on November 22nd, I filed a human rights application with the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, and there's a few parts to the application, but basically the main complaint is the way that it's decided which people will be kept on maximum security and which people will be kept on medium security. So in provincial jails, which are the jails that you would be in if you're either not convicted of anything yet, so basically, you know, innocent, or if you've been convicted to a sentence of 2 years or less, you would be in a provincial jail. And in those jails, there's only maximum or medium facilities. So in federal prisons, you also have minimum security, which is different. But the lowest security level in a provincial jail is medium security. And so the problem being that some people are kept on maximum for a really, really long time, and the difference between maximum and medium is really quite big. But mainly the gist of the application is that there's not a proper process, there's not a proper transparent process for people to know why they're being held on maximum security, and there's not, because you can't even know why it is, then you don't also have too many options for grieving the process or for grieving the decision that the jail has made. And most importantly is that there are certain people who actually just by default cannot ever be sent to medium security. And the two main categories that I'm complaining about in my application is people who are on immigration hold. So people who are potentially at the end of their process liable to be deported, and also people who have certain physical disabilities. So, for example, the medium security units at Vanier Center for Women are not at all wheelchair accessible. So if you're in a wheelchair, there's absolutely no way, regardless of your charge, regardless of your behavior, that you could ever be put on a medium security range.
And now for GrandWire's Community Radio Report. First, we'll start with Community Radio headlines. On December 21st, the new Human Resources Survey is due. Please contribute data from your station, as good data from the campus community radio sector has proven very beneficial to many. Montreal station CJLO has been chosen to take part in the University of Minnesota station Radio K's Foreign Trade Music Exchange. Radio K's annual partnership puts a spotlight on its partner's local music, arts, and culture scene. And from November 25th to December 10th, an internet campaign to denounce gender-based violence via radio shows took place. The campaign was organized by the Women's International Network of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. You can find the campaign's podcast at amarc.org. And a few GrandWire episodes ago, we covered a story about Ayanda Nagoma, the business manager at CFRC Queen's University Radio, who lost his job when his position was suddenly cut. Nagoma confirms that the position of business manager has been reinstated at CFRC, and he reapplied for his old job and is now back at work. So welcome back. And all 69 licensed NCRA members submitted annual returns to the CRTC by November 30th, and 68 completed the process by the same date. Congratulations to everyone. And now, for the community radio feature, we'll look at the NCRA's newest member station out of Nova Scotia, QCCR.
Sure, I'm Dan McLaren. I'm the station manager, and I also do some on-air work doing commercials, interviews.
My name is Dick Henneberry, and I'm the sales manager. Primarily my job, I get advertising.
Well, I've got to admit, I never, frankly, heard of the NCRA until I started to see this email. The convention that we went to, or the meeting we went to in Cheticamp, was an excellent meeting. It was well-run. The people from the NCRA that were there knew their stuff and they were able to make it simple. I mean, they handed out some thing about some CRTC regulations that, frankly, you would have needed a lawyer to read, and they handed this thing out, and it became so simple and so clear that, I mean, the decision to join the NCRA and the relatively small cost of doing that has paid for itself in spades, as far as I'm concerned. We have about a total of 12 volunteers that come in at different hours. There is no paid staff here at all. Everybody's a volunteer. We don't have the, as Dick said, the station was less than successful, I guess, would be the nice way to put it. And we've had to basically rebuild the station financially from the ground up.
So we're learning. We're like babes. But we're learning very fast.
That's it for this edition of GrandWire from CKUT in Montreal. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Erin Hudson. Music this week was by Montreal band Ott. Headlines this week were written by Erin Hudson. We also thank Carly Forbes, Guelph Prison Radio, and Frida Warren. Tune in again to hear GrandWire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. GrandWire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.